You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Oh, look, it's Derek Davison and Danny Bessner of the American Prestige Podcast, and I'm Robert Wright of Non-Zero Podcast. It must be that time that comes every 2 months or so that makes us wish there was a word that unambiguously meant every 2 months. You know, bi-monthly means both every 2 months and every 2 weeks. It kind of undermines its usefulness. But anyway, we get together every so often and have this high synergy inter-podcast thing about foreign policy. Is that the way you guys describe it?
Yeah, this is like the Jason Calacanis podcast, you know, just all-stars. Podcast world all stars, but I was thinking we need a.
So wait,
am I
David Sacks? Am I David Sacks?
No, you're Calacanis.
No, I am not Calacanis. I mean, I am on some of the same like enemies of Ukraine lists that David Sacks is on. But on the other hand, yeah,
it is funny how everyone hates Calacanis. He's like the big loser of the tech world, and he wants to be cool so bad, and it'll never ever happen for him.
What a world.
He's the one who I mean, if people don't know, we're talking about the All In podcast, which is loved by some and hated by some. A bunch of tech bros having a good time and talking about the expensive wine they drink.
Yeah, bunch of business geniuses. But we do need a name. I mean, we're not the Parrot Room. I was thinking, could we be the Cockroach Space? We're not Small Potatoes, but we need something else.
Let me get back to you on the cockroach thing. We'll focus group that. I don't know. I mean, anyway, we shouldn't get too self-involved. What's going on in the world? Have you guys been paying attention?
It is kind of funny how everyone forgot about Trump's assassination. I thought maybe we could start with that because, Bob,
nothing. I mean, it did nothing for him. It changed nothing. It's astonishing to me.
I actually wanted to ask Bob this because, Bob, like, you're the media vet here. And, like, there was a world when that would have been, like, probably a several-month-long story. So how does this, like, how have the rules changed for what matters? Like, even, like, last week when we were talking about, like, Whitmer or Shapiro, and it's like Kamala. You know, like there's no discussion about any of this. I feel like things have just gotten accelerated in a variety of different ways. And you must have been able to see that from up close being a media vet.
Yes, there are no surprises to me. I envision everything that is to come. I mean, first of all, of course, the assassination attempt got partly squashed by Biden dropping out. Masterfully timed, although probably, you know, not on purpose. And, you know, maybe relatedly, Trump didn't do the strategically optimal thing with it, which I thought was to kind of start seeming to be a slightly changed person and win over a few skeptical voters who previously considered him, you know, unlikable for one reason or another. I mean, he started his convention speech with that. The assassination thing, which some people found very moving and a sign that maybe he had changed, I thought of as kind of self-indulgent. But in any event, he quickly segued from that into Trump on the stump, random thoughts occurring. And so he didn't sustain the storyline of a new Donald Trump. Meanwhile, we got a new presidential candidate on the Democratic side. And now we're on that media cycle, which is... And that raises a bunch of interesting questions. You know, who's the vice president going to be? To people like us, what's her foreign policy inclination going to be like? What's her foreign policy team going to be like? What's the vice president's foreign policy inclination going to be like? And so on.
Do you think there's anything like contributing to this? Like just the fact that this has like been memory hold. Anything to the fact that the shooter turns out to have been... Like, there's no interesting angle here. This is just a troubled kid who was Googling, you know, like, how to shoot a president. How far was Oswald away from Kennedy? Like, he just wanted to take a shot at somebody. There's no angle here to play up that's, like, juicy or political in any way. It's just kind of, you know, there's nothing to that. And, you know, there is the angle of, like, the Secret Service fucking up and you know, causing this to happen. But I think people are almost, like, deadened to the idea of government agencies fucking things up because it just happens so constantly anymore. and it became a partisan thing in Congress. I mean, it just became, you know, more Republicans, you know, yelling at somebody and Democrats kind of, you know, yelling at the Republicans, and it just kind of blended into the background.
Yeah. That makes sense. I mean, the guy is kind of a cipher. It sounds like you know more than I do. I didn't know about the Oswald Googling, but yeah, he's just kind of a blank slate. I mean, at the same time, that does, some of these features made this, you know, ripe for conspiracy theorizing of various kinds. And there was that. But then the right-wing conspiracy theorists got sidetracked onto Biden is locked in a basement conspiracy theories. So that took some of the energy out of that. I think the left-wing conspiracy theorists are still sure that there was like a red gel pack, you know, underneath Trump's orange hair or something. But
let's not call them the left, Bob. Those are blue anon libs.
Blue anon libs.
Yeah, okay. That's not the left by any stretch of the
imagination. No, I'm sorry. I didn't mean that any socialist, Danny, would ever about anything.
The actual, you called them on a recent podcast, you're like the actual left, which I appreciated. I forget with whom.
What even you would call the actual left.
Yes, the actual left, yes.
Sometimes I just use your name as a substitute. I say the Danny Bessner left, right, and everyone knows what I mean.
I think that's fair. That's what you should be doing.
Yeah. So I mean, as I said several podcasts ago, it's like it does seem more plausible that we're living in a simulation. I mean, everything about the assassination was so weird.
It was very weird, and I was also curious, like. Because I feel like back in the day, maybe I'm misremembering, like when the media talked about like candidates and stuff, that might have an effect. And it just seems like that has zero effect now. Like the media is just basically, it is pure entertainment. It has almost no impact on how politicians really think about things. It has no impact on which leaders are chosen. It just seems like a very nihilistic moment in terms of media's effect on things. I want to know if that's incorrect, or if so, have you noticed that change over time?
Well, some of us are old enough to remember when there was the media, right? There really was this kind of a more or less homogeneous thing that arrived at consensus that represented the elite consensus. You know, there was right and there was left, but everybody knows the media, the technology of it was more conducive to centralization and so on. And so I think, you know, that's one, I mean, it's an interesting question. I mean, nobody, you know, where do you tune in? Like, if you wanted to hear smart analysis right after the fact that was detached and objective about anything that happens, a convention speech or whatever, like, where do you turn?
Yeah, there's really nowhere. And I think, like, a lot of, I think about
Newsmax.
Newsmax, Truth Social,
obviously. That's my go-to.
But I was thinking about this in relation to the, I don't know if you guys have been paying attention to this, the so-called resistance historians, quote unquote resistance historians, you know, historians.
You mean the regular resistance, the original resistance, yeah, the Trump historian?
Like the pink hat. Yeah.
Yeah. I won't name names, but there was an article recently about that in Slate about them. And they've just like, you know, thinking about that, they all these facile analogies to like the Confederacy or fascism. And I just think that there's been this association of scholars with political partisanship that, and basically, frankly, very shitty analysis of what's going on that has almost totally undermined, at least from when you're thinking historically, from like what type of people are listened to on television. And it just seems that there's no center. I mean, people have been making this argument for a while, but there's no center to even go for like smart analysis, and to the degree where the people who this is supposed to affect in power just don't care, like, whatsoever. Think about all the brain space that was spent on like talking about Whitmer It's just not even an it's not even floated once. And that to me was a very strong example of how the media.
What is not floated once? You mean
that she's really going to be on the ticket with Kamala, or that she was going to maybe replace Kamala? And that was just such like a long conversation that people had online for like weeks, and it's just totally ignored. And I mean myself. Like, I've been blackpilled a little bit, because how many times could I write the same fucking foreign policy article, you know, for basically an audience of no one? And it just feels like very pointless in a sense.
So the resistance historians, you sure you don't want to name names? I'm curious. Now, this was like a cynical piece in Slate about the resistance historians. It was anti-resistance historian.
Yes, it was basically saying that their analysis is like really incorrect and actively misleading. I believe Heather Cox Richardson was the one who was spoken about at most length. She has an extraordinarily successful Substack, but there's also Kevin Cruz is someone who's regularly on MSNBC. Those are probably the two most well-known people. And of course, Cruz famously had that plagiarism scandal at Princeton.
But what's a part of their take that's wrong? I mean, I'm sure it is.
I think the big critique that the left has is basically blaming it on an inevitable and permanent racism in the United States that will never be overcome. And so it's basically a fatalistic. Well, I mean,
Trump. Yeah. So Trump, all Trump followers are evil. The resistance narrative. Yeah,
exactly. Like all Trump followers are evil. And that compare. And also like making there was a lot of support for Joe Biden in general amongst this crew, saying that like it would be horrible for him to leave. And something has changed, because now historians are like really, really publicly critical of this crew in a way that they just weren't. Like people are basically like, these people are foolish. They're totally misleading. And that's what's interesting, is that like the historians, the untenured or the mostly non-tenured track, because the academy has been destroyed, are now like really coming after these people. So it does seem like something has changed in the water, but sorry, Derek.
No, the criticism that I saw was of Richardson specifically for saying something like, history shows that when you change a presidential candidate this late in the cycle, you lose. And it's happened like twice. Like, what are you drawing conclusions? Like, how are you drawing major conclusions from something that has hardly ever happened? Like, it's happened in the rarest of circumstances. But because she's a, you know, well-known historian, this has the imprimatur of a serious academic saying, you know, in my analysis of historical events, I can show that this, you know, this is a bad idea. And that was at the height of the, like, you know, right after the debate, you know, what are we going to do about this guy? He looked like he was about to die on stage. We got to find a new way forward. And it's just like, you know, you're trading on your academic reputation to just make basic, you know, political commentary, which, you know, I think is part of what frustrates people.
Yeah, and sort of pedantic. And just, I should give a shout out to the article. The article is by William Hoagland. I believe that's how you pronounce his name. Titled is "The Age of the Resistance Historian Coming to an End." The fact that if someone's even asking that question does suggest it is. But I think it is related to the larger point you're making about the real lack of faith and expertise. The fact that basically historians have turned themselves into political hacks and basically doomsayers. Another famous one who's not quite resistance, but has been recently getting a lot of criticism, is Yale's Timothy Snyder, who's written,
I was about to mention him. Yeah.
Yeah. And so like kind of embarrassed, like historians are now a little bit embarrassed by him, like these strange sort of cones.
It's about time.
Sort of mentioning how like this is the end of democracy, but also like I'll give you a sticker if you buy my book. So it just seems like there is a something shifting here, which is very different from like the moment when you were talking about when there was the media and that people were really like trusting experts.
I mean, first of all, I think it's a good sign. I haven't paid that much attention to Slate, which long ago I wrote a column for, but it's good that they ran this piece, because right after Trump won, they were like resistance central, as I recall. They had a very resistance-y mentality, you know, Trump followers evil, they must be squashed, rather than like try to earnestly look into what their actual motivations for voting for him were, and seeing that actually, first of all, they're diverse. There's different kinds of Trump voters. Secondly, many of them have grievances that not so long ago we associated with left of center politicians and so on. So that's, it's good that that's in Slate. You know, I think the discipline of history is may help explain some of this. I mean, first of all, as for extrapolating from a total of two data points, it's not a very quantitatively literate discipline by and large. Not the way sociology or much of political science is now.
Quantitative stuff is bullshit. But I'll leave.
Well, I forgot about that. Thank you for that reminder.
It's ontologically ridiculous to try to quantify human behavior. We can talk about the replication crisis.
That aside, we can set that debate aside. The if you listen to Timothy Snyder, there's something else you pick up on, which is that you can become a pretty famous historian, well, I mean, without doing good analysis, but instead just doing, it's like all rhetorical. It's almost like poetry. If you listen to some of the lines he says that get a lot of attention, even in a lecture setting, it's like, wait, what does this mean? I mean, you know, it's that was beautiful and powerful. But like, what the fuck are you talking about? And, you know, there are great historians out there, but anyway, I don't want to get into an extended critique of historians. I've got enough enemies. I'm on enough enemies list. I love historians. Some of my best.
No, you haven't been sanctioned by the Russian government, at least, unlike Danny here. So
yeah, I'm the only brave freedom fighter on this podcast.
Wait, you got sanctioned by the Russian government?
Do you not know?
Have we not
this?
Talked about this? We surely
maybe we did. I guess we did. Yeah, but I what you know the most recent enemies of Ukraine list had me, and it claimed that everyone on the list opposed sending any arms whatsoever ever to Ukraine, which is not true of me. But
true of me. I should have been on that list too. I wanted to get you know the EGOT of the sanction list. It would have been awesome to be sanctioned by both Ukraine and
that
Russia.
Would be. wait, what was Russia's grievance? About you?
I think there was no real grievance. My sense is it was a bureaucrat who had to go through like professor of international relations titles and added them to the list. There wasn't a specific grievance.
Uh-huh. You were just a token.
I was just a token.
Yeah, well, congratulations. You should go for the Daily Double.
It's on my CV and it's on my website. I'd say that I was sanctioned by Russia.
We are an impressive group. Derek, what list are you on?
I never get on any lists. It's like I'm simultaneously happy to have a low enough profile that nobody puts me on these freaking things. But every once in a while, one of them will come out, and I'll be like, "Oh man, I should have been on that list. What's going on?" So it's a double edged sword, but I'm okay with it.
Yeah. So, what were you guys? Where were you guys on the Biden replacement thing? I assume you're cheering for him to exit stage left. And then the question is who you wanted to replace him or.
I mean, there's no one to replace him. I was pretty fucking nihilistic about it. Everyone sucks. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he can't be replaced.
He's unrivaled among world leaders.
Yeah. He's irreplaceable. I don't know. I think I speak for Eric and myself. We were kind of, they're all shit. They're all going to be bad on the issues we care about.
We saved a lot of time.
You know, I mean, as much as I would like to say his support for genocide is what did him in, we know what did him in, and I'm just not, you know, who cares at that point? Anybody who replaces, I mean, it's going to be Kamala, but the policy is not going to change. So
yeah, who'll get rid of the FTC? She's going to get rid of Lena Khan. Yeah. First thing she
there
does
is that.
Is
she could be worse than
Silicon
worse
Valley.
On something.
We're so fucked. We are fucked. And I think this is honestly, Bob. To be honest, you probably could tell from our Twitter exchange. Like I wasn't spending that much time thinking about it because I thought whatever I thought wasn't going to matter, and whoever it's going to be is going to be pretty bad. And I think they're probably likely to beat Trump. I think people are sick of Trump and excited to vote for literally anything new. But like the crash course that our country is on is just going to continue given the absolute abysmal state of the Democratic Party and the candidates that they were able to offer. Pathetic shit, you know, really pathetic.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think it's, I mean, I don't want to get like into horse race stuff, but I do think it's an interesting moment of relief that there's somebody else to vote for other than Joe Biden and Donald Trump. Like that you could almost see the like sigh of relief from people. And I think, you know, the polling that's changed and the all the fundraising that she was able to do in the first couple of days reflects that. And it's going to be to me, what happens in the rest of the campaign and whether she's able to defeat Trump comes down to whether or not she can basically maintain that, you know, that sigh or that sense of relief, or if she's going to, you know, if people being introduced to her over in an intense way over the next couple of months is going to, you know, cause that to all come
well,
to an end.
Speaking of a resistance mentality, you know, I may be wrong, but my view is that she would be well advised to like not spend much time demonizing Trump, certainly not his followers. Just go positive. I mean, everyone has an opinion about Donald Trump. The people who hate him, hate him. And if they think she's the person who can replace him, they will vote for her. And then a bunch of people are devoted to him. And then there's these people, there's a small but very significant number of people in the middle. And I just think they are waiting for just something a little, this is why I think Trump missed such an opportunity in not embracing the role of new Trump, who is a national healer. I think a lot of people are just sick of all the polarization and shit and would just welcome somebody who doesn't spend all their time demonizing the other side and calling them a threat to the fabric of America. In any event, I think the small number of people who are up for grabs are many of them are in that category. But Kamala came out and granted she was talking to her staff. It was like right away, or maybe to the new campaign staff she had inherited, I forget, but and so she wanted to rally the base and she said, I'm gonna unify the party and I'm gonna unify the nation. And then she went immediately into the indictment of Trump as a serial criminal and offender and so on. And I just, you know, tweeted that there's a little tension between uniting the nation and just like immediately launching into that. But
there is. No, I think you're right. I mean, like, it's interesting because I think people are super angry at this moment. I imagine it felt similar at some point in the 1970s, but I also think people are exhausted. And I think right now this is an election where people will want to get over the exhaustion. The thing about Kamala, which I like, is that she's such a strange person. She's so like off-putting in a lot of like weird ways. Like she like laughs strangely. I like that because it's fucking weird. And at least there's something like weird in American politics. But that to me, I find that endearing. I mean, I think she'll be terrible on basically every policy. And I mean, better than Trump, but that's not saying much. Better than a standard Republican, better than whatever Trump is. But she's so weird that I like the weirdness. Bring weird back to American politics.
I think there's a way to campaign because she does, to some degree, have to get back a lot of people who left Biden, whether it was over Gaza or because they saw him, you know, look like a feeble, incapable old man on the debate stage or for whatever reason that have like, you know, drifted away from Biden. She does have to try and get those people back. And but there's a way to do it to me that isn't as divisive as, you know, kind of laying into Trump as this grand threat to democracy and this is the most important election of our lifetimes and all that like fever pitch stuff that just contributes to everybody's exhaustion. You can just do it with like, you know, this was only 4 years ago. Like you guys remember how fucking weird this guy was as president, right? Like just how bizarre everything was and how exhausting it was to have him as president. And like, we don't want that again. Like I think there's a message that could work there as a negative about Trump that isn't this, you know, kind of like high-pitched shrieking about, you know, ending America or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I think also embracing Biden's legacy, she's going to have to defend it one way or the other. And, you know, I think just explaining, you know, I really think politicians should make more use of like simple graphics that everyone can understand. And I think, you know, The Republicans are making a big deal of inflation. And I think it's not that hard to say, look, here's the way economics works. Sometimes the policies that generate a lot of jobs, which we wanted to do and have succeeded in doing, are somewhat inflationary. The trick is to get the inflation to start coming down right away and then show them the graph. This is where inflation was 2 years ago. This is the direction in which it's headed, steeply down. People can understand a graph that simple. Tell that story. So,
Bob, this is actually interesting because this relates to a larger subject that I'm curious about. So I'm a historian of social science. Like, this is one of the things that I studied. It does seem there are moments in American history where people are more or less interested in social science. I think this is not a moment of social science. I think that people feel that the economy isn't good, that their lives are harder. For, you know, millennials, it's difficult to own a home. Many millennials aren't having children because it's so expensive. Daycare, blah, 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 blah. And the macroeconomic data does not reflect that. And I would say, as people like Tim Shank have studied, because the macroeconomic data is mostly bullshit. And so, like, people aren't going to be able to draw those connections, I think, right now. So one of the problems I think we have is that there's no language of politics, because there's no language of social science that people really trust. We were just talking about that language of expertise. There's no language of mass politics, because masses clearly don't affect actual policy. You could see that from George Floyd. You could see that from the anti-Iraq war protests. So we're in a moment where the literal language of how we talk about politics doesn't reflect people's feelings. But because the Democratic Party is now just so professionalized, like the rest of our society has become in the last century, they all go to the same, you know, top 50 schools, probably really top 20 schools, and they have no connection to how ordinary people actually understand politics. There's a disconnect between how they literally campaign and think about what's going on in the world and what will attract voters. And this happens like every, you know, 50 to 70 years when previous norms and assumptions no longer hold. But I don't see what comes next. There's clearly no FDR-like figure who's able to speak a novel language of politics to actually reflect people's reality. So we're stuck with basically old gerontocrats or strange people like Kamala, who basically got on the ticket in a very weird, very specific to 2020 in particular way, and is now going to leave the country.
I think this is maybe restating some of what Danny said, but to get back to your idea of, you know, kind of bringing the graph out and explaining to people that inflation is coming down, I think you run the risk of the people you're trying to talk to feeling like you're talking down to them or kind of denying their lived experience. Because even if you can point to a graph and say, look, inflation was, you know, 6%, now it's down to 2%, you're still, I'm still, as the person you're talking to, I'm still grappling with the fact that prices were at one level 4 years ago and that they're at a much different level that's harder for me to accommodate now. And that's my lived experience. So I don't know. I mean, it's very tricky to kind of try to do that. I understand what you're experiencing, but here's the fact. Here's what's really happening. Like, it's tricky to pull that off without it sounding like you're condescending.
You have to acknowledge the pain in the first place. Either way, you've got to say to people, look, I understand, but I don't think, you know, when you show people a graph, I don't think everyone thinks you're talking down to them. I think some people think the opposite. Oh. She thinks I'm smart enough to get a graph. But who knows? I mean, but they're going to try to saddle her with it. She's going to have to acknowledge the reality that prices have risen. And then she's going to have to say something else. I don't know. What's your candidate for what she says next?
I'm not Donald Trump, basically. I think there is a facticity problem. Like, all this talk about misinformation and disinformation is that people don't believe in... The economy, if you look at it like philosophically, is not a social fact, right? We could all admit that. It's a massive aggregation of a million different things. And that language just doesn't work anymore. So my guess is that she's just going to campaign on, I'm not Donald Trump. I'm young. I'm not 1,000 years old. I understand what, like, so you can't regulate social media like you regulated telephones. Mm-hmm. So I think that if I were her, and I would advise against, obviously these horrible Democratic consultants get, they lose every fucking election. But I would advise her to just be like, I'm young and different. That's basically it.
She is young. She's only 59. I mean, compared to Trump and Biden, she's
a neophyte.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. So I guess we are approaching the time when traditionally what we do is go into this part of the conversation that at the Non-Zero podcast we call overtime. I don't know if you guys have a name for it. It's a bonus time or something, but the two ways
the pay-up time.
To get. Yeah. That I would never put it that way, but yeah. So the two ways to get access to this are if you're not already a Non-Zero member and want to become a paid subscriber, you can do that at the Non-Zero newsletter Substack, or you can do that at the American Prestige. You guys are on Substack as well as being a podcast, correct?
We are on Substack, and they should subscribe to both. You know,
there's a discount. Should we do this? I mean, first, let me say one thing I want to talk about in this next segment is I was initially dismissive of there being any reason for hope about a Kamala Harris foreign policy. I have found actual cause for hope. And there's actually going to be a piece about
this. Excellent tease. That's really good. That's going to get
The piece is also going to be in Friday's Non-Zero newsletter. So it's just, I'm just kind of, I mean, my promotional skills, people say, Bob, how do you do it? You know, how did you become the world's greatest promoter of podcasts and newsletters? And I point to you, Derek, as my.
That could not possibly be because I'm terrible at it. But
you got a major enterprise going. But I was thinking what we should do is that discount link. Maybe we do this already. But in our, so we each have a post representing this podcast that you get full access to if you're a paid subscriber. And then of course in both cases you can set up your personalized feed that always has the bonus content. But do we already put your discount subscription link in our post and put our discounts in your post? And that way,
I think so. We do on our end. I don't. Okay. I think so.
Well, if we're not doing it, we will. So anyway,
That's what they all say.
Yeah. I'll get back to you on that. There are huge, huge savings to be harvested here. Massive synergy between these two podcasts. And we encourage everyone to stick around the rest of the conversation, but thanks whether or not you're going to for listening this far.